Hi, this is Liz Chung. You don't often hear from me because I'm busy working behind the scenes as the producer of Bioethics in the Margins, but I'm popping in today to share an exciting announcement on behalf of the whole team. Bioethics in the Margins is thrilled to announce that we were awarded the prestigious 5th Annual Dr. Claretta Dupree Award in recognition of our vision and commitment to justice in bioethics by the American Society of Bioethics and Humanities Race, Culture, Ethnicity Affinity Group during the annual meeting last week. We are honored and enormously grateful for this recognition for our labor of love. Words cannot express what this honor means to the whole team. We would like to extend our deepest gratitude to Dr. Dupree and the leadership of the Race, Culture, Ethnicity Affinity Group, as well as all of our team members, including hosts Drs. Kirk Johnson and Amelia Barways, founding member Nicole Strand, senior advisor Dr. Steven Sodecki, sound editor Madeline Mahoney, creative director Gargi Pandey, music producer Dr. Pablo Cortas, social media manager Wendy Jiang, website manager Serhat Caracas, and many student volunteers over the years, including Ava Randall, Gabriel Akinporoye, August Yu, Veda Kota, and Rachel Aiden, among others. We are most grateful for the intellectual generosity of all of our guests, without whom there would be no podcast.
Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Welcome to Season 8 of Bioethics in the Margins, and we have a really special podcast lined up for today with four amazing speakers. I'm going to just introduce them now. First, we have Stephen Muldrum, PhD. He's an assistant professor and the research program director in bioethics and health humanities at the University of Texas Medical Branch School of Public and Population Health. He holds the James Wade Rockwell Distinguished Professorship in Medical Humanities, and he's an ethnographer, qualitative social researcher, and health policy scholar. Krishna Chokshi, MD, is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Hospital Medicine at the Mount Sinai Hospital in NYC, and she's the director of the Clinical Ethics Consult Service and the chair of the Ethics Committee. Dr. Chokshi also serves as the Content Area Director for Medical Ethics with the ICAN School of Medicine and Mount Sinai's ASCEND curriculum and oversees the hospital's primary palliative care program within the Division of Hospital Medicine. Jonathan Schaefer, PhD, is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Vermont. His academic interests have focused on the intersection of global health, human rights, science, and technology studies and social movements. He was previously the Hecht Levi Postdoctoral Fellow in Global Infectious Disease Ethics at the Johns Hopkins University Berman Institute of Bioethics. And finally, we have Zachary Berger, MD, PhD, and he is an associate professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and in the Division of General Internal Medicine. He is a faculty member of the Berman Institute of Bioethics. He is an internist, clinical epidemiologist, and bioethicist. And Dr. Berger's clinical, educational, and research work is located at the intersection of shared decision-making, patient-centered care, and evidence-based medicine. So you're all very welcome here, and thank you so much for coordinating to be on the podcast together. So we're here today to discuss the workshop that you all organized last year for the American Society of Bioethics and Humanities Conference, titled Reimagining Bioethics Together. So before we delve into that and what became of that and where you're headed with that, can you tell us how you got to work on this together and how you became interested in this topic and wanted to speak to bioethicists about it?
I think that this is one of those moments where people from different directions are having similar thoughts in common. I had first known John previously through some political activism we did together, and have followed his work with interest. And he was at the Berman Institute as a postdoc, and I have been there as a faculty member. And we were talking about his work on understanding how a principalist and often individualist approach to bioethics does not help us understand the systemic failings of bioethics and systemic challenges to having equitable healthcare. And so then he told me about Stephen's work, and then fortuitously, and I'm just going to give this from my individual perspective, and then fortuitously at the same conference at which I met Stephen through John, I heard about Dr. Tursky's work and saw her present about her quantitative and empirical and ethical work at Mount Sinai. So it was a very fortuitous interdisciplinary meeting of minds, I think, that really spoke to me about the efforts to address these systemic failings of bioethics.
Well, I can say something too. I think I agree with Zach, and that we had our first meeting. I think it was me, John, and Zach, just in one of the breaks during ASBH 2023, where we had a conversation that was about sort of how can we think about bioethics as a field, but also bioethics as an academic formation with, right, of course, an annual conference as a space where we can do certain kinds of work around social transformation and bioethics, but also as a space that was sort of ripe for holding new kinds of conversations about bioethics potentially as an agent for being a site of social transformation and how to go about that. And so it started sort of as a conversation around the talks that we were giving. And then I think, you know, we decided, well, let's try and get something together for the next ASBH. They have these roundtables. And that was in 2023. And then we had our session in 2024, which is where I believe we met, Liz.
So why do you think that bioethics needs reimagining? You've touched on this a little bit, but do any of you want to expand on that, John?
Sure, yeah. Like maybe I can chime in just as, I don't know, maybe someone who's a bit of an interloper, you know, I feel that way sometimes, as a sociologist. You know, my training is in sociology, and sociologists tend to be interested in, you know, the social construction of boundaries, how certain forms of discourses get produced by institutions and groups of people. And so I couldn't help but, as I entered into a bioethics department at the Berman Institute, be really interested in, well, how was the Berman Institute constituting the object of bioethics? How did scholars come together around sets of shared terms and theories? And, you know, and how did they sort of come together with other bioethicists from other centers of institutional shared work at something like ASBH? And found tremendously interesting sets of conversations, things that we would never sort of touch on within sociology, questions about, you know, extraordinary, you know, sort of kind of fringe science that is being done in places like Johns Hopkins University or Harvard, in these, you know, tremendous research institutions and enormous ethical and moral questions that they present, things that are pretty foreign to, I think, most sociologists or other critical social scientists. But one of the things I was sort of perplexed by or puzzled by was sort of an absence of, you know, sociological kinds of theorizing about moral and ethical life. I mean, sociologists have their own sort of terms of art to think about the production of shared norms and moral ideas in the context of social settings and shared work. And, you know, seeing those kinds of ideas being, you know, not frequently foregrounded within bioethical conversations was a first observation. And then also sort of an absence of, you know, moral, not complete absence, but relative absence, I should say, of some of the sort of more politically oriented kinds of moral thinking and moral theorizing, and sort of being curious about that combination and trying to think from a sociologist standpoint, well, what could I do or bring to these conversations that might be fruitful for bioethicists in their own work, whether it be clinical bioethics or more kind of academic philosophical kinds of inquiries. And that, yeah, just to piggyback off what had already been said, these were concerns that Zach had brought up and Stephen, and then it's been wonderful to learn from Krishna as well through these conversations.
Well, you've all got so many diverse skills. Sorry, go ahead, Kirk.
No problem. Thank you, John, for that insight. That is definitely helpful. The next question is for Stephen, and I'm curious of what aspects of your work led you to the conclusion that significant changes to the field are necessary. What are one or two things that you say, you know what, we could do better. We need to have a particular shift in order to make things more progressive in this field.
Thanks for the question. You know, I actually want to build on something in responding to this that John was saying near the end of his comments, which is, you know, there is a philosophical and political philosophical tradition that bioethics comes from, which is sort of the liberal democratic, Rawlsian, Habermasian tradition in liberal democratic political philosophy. And I actually was looking when I got to ASBH for sort of if there were people at the conference who were coming to some core questions in bioethics from other political vantages in political theory, which is sort of one of my hobby horses. I'm trained mainly in science and technology studies. Within bioethics, I am most situated within public health ethics, which I actually see for a variety of reasons as having a particular charge to hold space in the field for really transformative notions of social justice because of the very long history of public health institutions emerging from social movements that demanded things like the creation of departments of sanitation and health in the 19th century, right? I make all my public health ethics students read the great book, The Sanitarians by John Duffy, which talks about this. So really thinking about, right, the emergence of modern institutions that were designed to help, in many cases, the urban poor, emerging from processes of political struggle, right? And so I was looking for and craving a little bit more of this in bioethics, and I wasn't really finding that it existed very much, which sort of led me to wanting to think about, and in a couple of talks that I gave, work that I haven't published yet, bringing theories of left pluralism and thinking with folks like Antonio Gramsci and Chantal Mouffe to bioethical conversations to actually think about, well, how can we not only bring in a different set of values in bioethics, but different ways of thinking about the political within bioethics? And so, you know, articulating this vision on my part of bioethics, not just as a broker of disputes within biomedicine or an earwig that is, you know, trying to hold to account academic medical institutions and biomedicine as it exists. But bioethics, again, is this agentic actor within a pluralist political public sphere. This is sort of what brought me to this work. And the resources that I go to that are generally from traditions in political theory that are not the ones that are dominant in bioethics. So it's both a scholarly intervention and thinking differently about the direction that the field might go and thinking about its role in struggles for social transformation.
No, thank you, Stephen, for displaying that. Very interesting. And this is this question is for everyone that is a part of the panel. And well, first, tell us a little bit about the workshop. I know you alluded a little bit about it earlier, but if you could tell us a little bit about the workshop and how was it organized?
I mean, I just spoke, I'd throw it to some of my colleagues to share on that too. But basically, after that 2023 ASBH meeting, we started meeting somewhat regularly, initially kind of around the question of, you know, what would it mean for bioethics to treat capitalism as an object and to think about capitalism as an object and a problem within bioethics, which then kind of expanded to encompass a broader set of questions, which actually organized our workshop in 2024. We'd started meeting in 2023 and decided, hey, let's submit an ASBH workshop for 2024. And that became Remaking Bioethics Together. And that opened with four different presentations. I gave John's presentation for him. He couldn't be there. But the one that I gave, maybe we can each talk about how we opened that. It opened with four short presentations, and then we had breakout groups. And the presentation that I gave was about this part of the ASBH bylaws, which says, quote, the society shall not issue positions on substantive moral and policy issues, unquote, which is something I had heard people in the field griping about a bit because, right, if bioethics is supposed to be functioning as a conscience of biomedicine, how can it be that our professional society doesn't take positions? And I sort of put a bit of a provocation out there that I don't think that calling for universal healthcare is that controversial of a position for our field and should probably be something that the society considers taking a position on. So that was the one I led. And then maybe each person could talk about the short talk they gave that then staged the four breakouts.
Sure. Yeah, well, I wasn't there, so I can make mine brief. But Stephen very helpfully stepped in a moment where something came up for me. But yeah, mine was, you know, sort of trying to bring some simple but hopefully useful empirics to this intuition that I had sort of developed being a sort of sociologist interloper at the Berman Institute. So, you know, I used, you know, some simple tools of bibliometrics to try to map, well, what is this discursive field of bioethics? You know, where are its centers of gravity? What kinds of theoretical approaches tend to be privileged within the research corpus produced by these institutions? And so I showed some slides that, you know, made the case that, yeah, you know, unsurprisingly, Beecham and Childress and sort of principalist approach to at least biomedical ethics tends to be orders of magnitude more powerful or dominant within these citation networks of bioethical research. Again, probably unsurprising, but then also trying to look at, well, what are the material foundations of bioethical research centers? You know, where are the major funding sources that allow us to get paid, right, to do this abstracted sort of work, thinking about moral values in the contexts of biomedicine in the United States? What are the interests of those kinds of funding sources? And to make a point, building off of what Stephen says, that the institution of bioethics already does have a set of values that ground it, right? That aren't fully neutral or fully, I don't know, objective. That there is a positionality to the work of bioethical research, and that's not to diminish it in any way, but it is to be sort of empirically realistic about it as a starting point for saying, well, what kinds of values are privileged, and how might we think about introducing a different set of values or political perspectives, especially given the current sort of collective crises that we're living through, especially at this moment.
And I spoke as one of two clinicians on the panel, also a bioethicist and predominantly an outpatient clinician. And I spoke about the relationship between institutions, predominantly biomedical institutions, where a lot of prestigious bioethics or well-published, well-supported bioethics is located, and the life of the patient and the community and the clinician in my case. I work in two institutions seeing patients, and one of them is an academic medical center, Johns Hopkins, and the other is a community center that sees undocumented, uninsured, uninsurable patients. And I talked a bit about the relationships between biomedical institutions writ large, about which there's a considerable literature about how academic medical centers have worked with or as often exploited the surrounding communities to privilege their own ends, and how one might think about a bioethics that considers institutional ethics in the context between relationships between the community and what that term even means. How does one, who is in that community and these institutions? And just piggybacking a little bit what John said, in our current crisis full moment of many crises, thinking about the fate of my undocumented patients how they are treated in all senses, right, by our institutions, my institutions, is a particularly fraught.
I came to this really from the perspective of clinical ethics. And so when I was, you know, thinking about the sort of stories to really bring to the conference, I realized the stories and the cases that stuck with me were not cases that I consulted on as a clinical ethics consultant. So they were really cases from my day-to-day clinical work. And, you know, these were cases that weren't really classic ethical dilemmas, but rather systems ethics failures, right? There were impossible solutions. I talked about a man with brain cancer who couldn't go to a rehab and was too sick to go home. And he couldn't go to a rehab because insurance wouldn't pay for his cancer drugs. Or for a young woman who had uncontrolled diabetes and didn't have insurance and no one in our health system would see her outpatient. So it was really kind of these stories in these cases of how uninsured, unhoused, or just patients facing general social or economic barriers were being de-autonomized by our system. And these situations didn't make it to our ethics consult service because I think people felt these are really big problems. They're too big. They're unsolvable. They're systemic. There's nothing really that an ethics consult could help us with here. But I think these are exactly the kinds of cases that expose the deepest ethics failures in our healthcare system. And, you know, I think in reflecting, I was thinking if ethics doesn't claim these, then really no one names them as ethics problems at all. And so, you know, what I was sharing with others, and I think what resonated with a lot of the clinical ethics consultants in the workshop was that reimagining bioethics in our sort of subset of our field really means that we're sort of rethinking our work from just, you know, dealing with these workarounds for individual cases and being more advocates for larger, you know, institutional sort of reform and engaging in a more effective way with the patients and communities we serve.
Thank you, Christian. And I was going to ask you because I wanted to also hear your voice and your perspective. Before Milia goes into institutional and organizational ethics, as I know that also is a deeply rooted and connected and important theme, I'm curious, Krishna, did anything in the actual workshop surprise you? Any questions, any discussions, any topics that stuck out to you?
I think what surprised most of us was really how much energy there was in the room. I think people were really excited about the questions and the issues we were raising. And, you know, they immediately recognized these kinds of cases from their own practice. And so in our breakout rooms, we each led kind of a group, you know, to discuss our respective sort of topics. And I led a workshop breakout for clinical ethics folks. And I think the work really resonated with them. And I think we all shared sort of common values and vision around really wanting to be part of a more systemic solution for our patients. But there was a lot of questions of how do we do that? How do we get a seat at the table? How do we kind of get the buy-in of leadership? But I really saw an appetite across the field to broaden kind of what counts as clinical ethics and to really be more effective agents for this larger change and not just, you know, not just helping to resolve these individual cases.
Yeah, so just building off of that then, you mentioned organizational ethics. Do you think clinical ethicists or research ethicists within institutions can sort of serve as the conscience of the institution and have a role as an organizational sort of ethical group to help the institution address some of these deeper rooted questions that aren't just sort of on the one-to-one patient level, but are affecting sort of large groups of patients that are more related to social determinants of health and things like that. Is there a way for ethicists to, you know, work with the institutions in which they're in to look at these problems and find solutions?
I think that's exactly the work of clinical ethics. And I think many in the field are already doing that, especially when they're given the opportunity by their leadership. I think that there are sometimes constraining factors, right? It's hard to both be an advocate and to hold your institutions accountable, right? Sometimes when they're the ones kind of funding us, and it can be a bit of a tricky situation. But I think the main way to build the relationship with leadership is to show them that ethics isn't just about these individual cases or just about these abstract values, but it's directly linked to patient safety, quality, and community trust. And all the cases we talked about were ultimately not just systems ethics failures, they were really bad for patient safety and quality, right? And so I think all those things are the language that hospital leadership and institutional leadership really care about. I think health systems are under a lot of pressure right now, which makes them more open to thinking about kind of their values, their priority. And I think they're looking for guidance around how to really drive their institutional mission. So I think clinical ethicists have a really great opportunity right now to step into that role. And, you know, our job is not just to be honest and sort of point out the problems, but I think it's to really work with them on these kind of process and quality issues. And that's really what we try to do in our health system, is really think about how do we integrate ourselves into building the solutions, right? Not just bringing the problems to the table, but really being part of various hospital-wide initiatives to be helpful. And I think that combination of being honest and collaborative can really earn us a seat at the table.
Can I speak to that too? I think Krishna's comment was really thought-provoking, and I wanted to respond to that in a agreeing with it, but also from a different perspective, as you know, as also a clinical ethicist, and not quite with a seat at the table in regarding the QI aspect of our institution. And I think this goes to something else that was mentioned by John, and also the rest of us, I think, implicitly, that we're in a moment of crisis. And what does it take for our systemic questions to be heard at the table of clinical ethics, when so much of clinical ethics is about how to smooth the path for the ordinary status quo functioning of the institution, right? How do we make things happen so that patients get, from an inpatient perspective at any rate, and that's the vast majority of our consults, how do we smooth the path to people getting admitted, treated, and discharged, right? That's at the bottom of a lot of these clinical ethics consults. And so the systemic questions are heard to the extent they interfere with the smooth function of the institution. What is the function of the institution? What are the incentives of the institution? And there's a term I've learned recently from a book that I haven't read, but the term is a capitalist realism. And I think it's from a book by Mark Fisher. The idea is that capitalism is, to even consider alternatives to the systemic hegemony of capitalism, is to be a non-realist, right? To think of things that aren't possible. And so as we're in this moment of really terrible crisis for so many sectors of society, including the healthcare system, and hospitals are really with their back up against the wall, right? I do not envy, I really admire the work of my hospital executives, right? Trying to, the budgets are decreasing, support is vanishing. How do they treat patients, right? In a massive way. And so understanding the difference of direction there has to be some sort of implementation of difference, of change. And so maybe that's a route to be at the table and bring these systemic questions to the fore. Maybe that's where we clinical ethicists, and Chris is already doing that work, you know, maybe that's a way to get in, right?
Right, right. And before my friend and colleague Emilian jumps in, I'm just curious, because you said Zach is really intriguing, because if you do take a stance, particularly in the political climate that we're in, there can be fears of retribution in some type of way or form, right? By the upper echelons of government, right? So how, as a bioethicist, do you balance actually taking a stance, even though it's a moral stance and that it's a stance that you feel is virtuous, but at the same time, trying to, I guess, tiptoe around issues, for lack of a better term, because you don't want your institution to fear the consequences, whether that be socially, financially, you know, or systemically in any particular way, shape, or form. I'm interested because prior to this, you know, current administration, you could say something and you won't feel that there's any type of retribution. But now, of course, institutions are particularly careful because they don't want to harm themselves in any particular way. So I'm just curious, what are your thoughts on that? Granted, as Zach said, the political climate or the basic climate overall that we're in currently.
Yeah, well, no, it's a great question. I mean, maybe it raises another sort of conceptual term that doesn't come up in bioethics enough, perhaps, which is sort of an ontology and an analysis of power. So how is power functioning in these settings, right? What are the dependencies that our institutions are dependent on, which gives others power over those institutions that shape the kinds of ethical concerns that we have to deal with downstream in clinical consults or other kinds of day-to-day processes that we are confronted with on a daily basis. And so if there is some kind of fictitious but powerful capitalist realism that shape the kinds of contours and concerns that rise to the surface in institutionalized work, maybe there's a better and more useful sort of power ontology realism where we could have a serious accounting of how power works within capitalist biomedicine, or whatever it is we want to call the system under which we're living. And if we took power and its functioning seriously in our institutions, that might take us down the kinds of ethical and moral analyses and give standing to bioethics in a new way to make new kinds of claims collectively. You know, what that looks like and how to do it is a problem not just of intellectual work, though, but also of organizing and political work, right, which imposes new kinds of challenges, I think, for folks involved in them. And also, I should say, I mean, real risks, right, because, you know, the sort of maybe imagined neutrality sort of has been evaporated as the federal government has clamped down.
And maybe I'll say briefly that, you know, I'm doing some work in our institution, and I can't call it organizing and I can't call it political work, but I can call it talking to people, right? And I've talked to a number of people, both in medicine, public health, bioethics, and in other, you know, all of higher education, of course, in the US is under attack. And so one strategy I think at least many of us are settling on, at least a practical strategy, is it's thinking about power analyses, maybe not explicitly, but just realizing that we have to act in a way that helps support the putative goals of higher education, right? The idea of higher education as supporting freedom of thought and sustained inquiry and productive discourse, to support that in our institution. And so to look past or to be pragmatic about our disagreements with various administrative figures in our institution and thinking about building common cause to support the goal of higher education and of academic medicine. So that's sort of a strategic goal that I didn't think that way several months ago, right? I vehemently disagree with my leadership in various regards, right? But that's right now, at least pragmatically, setting that aside as I talk to people and discover what our common goals are.
Oh, and I'll take a stab at this one too. And I think, you know, Kirk, what your question and what this conversation is reminding me of is, right, that bioethics actually, relative to the other disciplines, has a special charge in this regard to hold space for these conversations within academic medicine, right, to help people deal with forms of moral distress that they might be experiencing in their jobs, for example, whether those are our colleagues or our students or hospital administrators, people who work within our milieu, right? And I think to link this back to the broader conversation that we're having is, you know, in a moment of crisis, is a point when major faults in systems sort of are shown to exist in ways that they were not visible before. And I think that building up a discourse within our field that helps people within bioethics and the folks we work with who are in roles in academic medicine or public health better see the structural constraints in which we all have to work and develop an analysis of that together is a very powerful way for, I think, building forms of solidarity and amongst each other and for providing new groundwork to analyze what is a rapidly changing situation in our country, in our field that directly impacts academic medicine, right? Whether we're talking about cuts to Medicaid in the health system or potential cuts to NIH and other streams of funding that our institutions rely upon, right? These are all determined by structural factors that it is very vital that we develop an analysis of. And within academic medicine, I think bioethics has a particular charge to hold space for conversations about these issues and should be doing that.
That's all really interesting, and I love all your perspectives. I do think it really needs people who have a passion for this to make change, and it's hard sometimes, I found, to get people interested in this. People are really just trying to get through their day sometimes and get their job done, and it's hard for them to think about these bigger problems or even have any appetite to do anything about them. So in the past, you know, bioethicists have been sort of essential in challenging the status quo, sort of disrupting. They've ended exploitative research on prisoners and institutionalized patients. And it feels, you know, I know you guys have a passion for this, and this is, you know, definitely evident in some circles, this idea of bioethics should be doing more for these huge systemic issues. But why do you think bioethicists generally are not doing this, and there is this sort of tendency to remain neutral about some of these bigger issues?
I mean, I guess I could speak, well, I don't mean to throw either any of one of us up as the best answer, but I say that I'll use terms that maybe John could use better. But I think it does go to sort of the incentivization of our profession as bioethicists and how those incentives work to constrain what is seen as permissible action. And I think the framing of the status quo operation of capitalist biomedicine as neutral, right, as facially neutral, is something we'd like to problematize, right, or question. What does it mean to think about these questions as neutral? And I think why is it that, for example, the individual clinician or bioethicist does not see these questions as systemic? I think it's because I think that the term burnout is overused, but I will say and one reason I was personally radicalized or maybe came into realization was by seeing just one patient after another that did not have the money to get care or get their medicines or get food or have stable housing, right? And so there's two kinds of reactions to that. And I'm not saying one is morally better. I don't really like the moralizing tendencies, right? But one reaction is to say, like, this is just, I can't deal with this. It's just too much. Like, you just have to get through. And so you identify workarounds, right, in the system to, sometimes it involves patient blaming, sometimes it involves justifying disparate levels of care as actually optimal. Sometimes there are other workarounds. That's one way of doing it. And another way of doing it is trying to be explicit about that moral distress and channel it. And so what happens, I think, in the justification of the status quo is the implicit argument, sometimes explicit too, that moral distress is to be avoided, that it's a net negative, and we need to do something with moral distress. That's not the best answer to the question, but I think it's sort of too psychologizing, but it's sort of an example, a description of what happens, at least in a number of clinicians that I know.
Yeah, maybe just to build off that, and is to think about, you know, any institution that we're a part of, you know, they're compromises, right? They're sort of practical compromises to do shared work. And I tend to think, you know, when things are working reasonably well, we don't have a huge interest in maybe upsetting the apple cart or transforming those kinds of systems. And so I think it, you know, institutions, you know, are meant to allow cyclical patterns, to allow repeatability, to allow us to have boundaries that are stable around our work lives and our personal lives, to allow us to predict what's coming next. That's what institutions do for us. And, you know, I think in times of tremendous change or huge problems, sort of like what we're under right now, institutions and the sort of scripts that we tend to operate within maybe don't work so well. And so now you have a new kind of conundrum that you have to contend with. And I think that we're sort of wrestling with this. This is part of the reason why maybe institutionalized bioethics has been relatively conservative and imagined itself as neutral. because it could, under the kind of consensus position of sort of a liberal capitalist biomedical set of systems. But yeah, under this current moment and set of intersecting crises, I think professionals of lots of stripes have to contend with maybe three things that get conflated. One being our material interests, that actually our jobs are at stake, our livelihoods are at stake in many ways. I mean, we look at sort of the evisceration of the federal government, the, you know, dissolution of NIH or NSF or CDC, professional staff, threats to closures of hospitals across the United States. I mean, these are threats to people's individual livelihoods and material interests. Our values, you know, what are the kinds of values we hold personally and professionally? And Zach brought up this interesting, you know, overlap in shared values between himself and leadership of his institution around freedom of academic knowledge production and freedom of speech, and that this is sort of like a set of values that we can kind of all agree to are really important for universities to function. So what are our values and when are they threatened? And then what are our resources? What resources do we have? You know, we have our labor, we have our time, we have other resources that we can bring to these struggles. But I think thinking about those things together could give us ways of thinking about new ways that we could work together outside of the maybe routinized, institutionalized scripts that kind of maybe don't serve us in times of crisis.
I wanted to just speak to something that Zach said that I thought was really powerful. And I think one of the takeaways from this work and from our workshop was sort of what do we do with moral distress? And I always used to, you know, as a clinician educator, I always used to think moral distress is something you try to address, right? You try to like kind of assuage it or sort of, it's like a bad thing. It's uncomfortable. We don't like feeling it. And we try to address it. And I think, collectively from our conversations, we really started to see it's actually a really powerful feeling and we need to channel it. And it's totally normal and okay to feel this distress and this pain and to feel other people's suffering and to be bothered by that, and that we should recognize those feelings and really do something with them and not just try to address it away. And it just helped me kind of shift how I talk to my trainees and students about these feelings, because I think that there are many things that people can do, even if they're very small within their institutions. But this shift for me has been really powerful, right? From just addressing it to really channeling it to do something.
I would add something here, and this is a great discussion. You know, and to get to this question of neutrality in bioethics, right? There are undeniably regulatory functions that bioethics has within biomedical capitalism, that institutionally and, you know, sort of the warrant of the field coming out of, you know, its origins in the 1970s has, right? There are regulatory functions that bioethics has within biomedical capitalism. Bioethics is central to the social and institutional reproduction of academic medicine and biomedicine writ large, right? We serve on IRBs. There are folks who do research ethics consultation services, clinical ethics consultation services that actually make the institution function, right? And those are roles that have to be fulfilled that are part of the day-to-day functioning of academic medical institutions, much in the same way that teaching and service that we do as faculty, for example, are part of our role. And the need to fulfill those obligations of the field, I think, are also counterweighted by what I've seen in my, 4 years really, going to ASBH and being really more involved in bioethics as a field. These are really sort of counterweighted, but what I've seen as an increasing recognition in the field that the systems that bioethics is involved in socially and institutionally reproducing really need to change in a big way. This is almost like a drumbeat at ASBH, right? We have sessions on abolitionist bioethics, urban bioethics, Black bioethics, feminist bioethics that are bringing this to the fore. It's like, well, we're socially reproducing this thing that we have a problem with, right? And I think that this is something that I would really like to lean into as these conversations continue, because the structural constraints of academic medicine, the superstructural infrastructural, ideological constraints of academic medicine are actually also the grounds from which it could be reimagined. And I think, like I've said before in this podcast, bioethics has a particular warrant to drive that reimagining, right? And I really think that making some of these challenges and framing these challenges as political challenges that can't just be addressed by going about our jobs to socially reproduce academic medicine as it is, these really ought to be increasingly central preoccupations of the field. And this gets us thinking within our institutions, but also outside of our institutions, right? The relationship between larger political structures and the reproduction of the institutions that our labor is a part of socially reproducing.
I'm glad you mentioned the abolitionist medicine, because one of our team, Dr. Nicole Strand, that's something that I believe she's spoken about at ASBH. So I think you're right. There's been more talks about this at ASBH. A lot of people are calling for bioethics to be a broader, thinking about broader issues that affect more people than the one-to-one issues that are often discussed. But it doesn't seem like ASBH it's doing some work along these lines. We have the DEI webinars, things like that. But have you had any discussions with ASBH, or do you see any appetite for them taking more of a stand on some of these issues or trying to be more engaged sort of in moving the field that way?
I mean, I can take a quick stab at this, which is like, no formal conversations with ASBH, although this is a kind of an open-ended discussion that we had in our last workshop and that we might have. And we had a meeting kind of in between ASBH 2024 and ASBH 2025, which is coming up as of the time of this recording, with a group of folks. But one of the open questions is sort of, should there be some more formalized space within ASBH for having these discussions is a question that we're exploring. But in terms of anything more formalized than that, no, not that I'm aware of. And I'll toss it to my colleagues there too.
Yeah, I don't think there's any formal conversation, but it's sort of an interesting question. Well, who is ASBH if not, a group of members and professionals trying to think through these things collectively? And so I think, our approach has been, let's start with our people, who are folks who are drawn to these kinds of concerns and puzzles and questions and see these as gaps or blind spots that need attention. And if we could, ground ourselves in that, I mean, that's a valued and values-oriented position. But, there's a lot that can be done through that to call the question, I guess, with colleagues and others in the field. That's how social change can be helpful and happen. And so maybe this creates the space or opportunity for, not to say bioethics will ever be univocal, and arguably it should not be, but that there are some lines that ought not to be crossed in our own societies and in our own institutions. And we're coming up to maybe some of those lines that demand some kind of response.
Well, I was going to say, we also wanted to mention that, we're sort of in a crisis mode now. Do you think there are specific opportunities that can arise from this current disruption? I'm talking politics, obviously. So do you think that this crisis can be used maybe as a way to sort of move the field in the direction that you are suggesting and that, we certainly agree with? That's why we have our podcast.
Yeah. Let me say a couple of things. And then I kind of want to pass it to Krishna, who's sort of in the trenches in an institution working on these things. I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on this. But I've been working with, it's far too grandiose to call it a social movement, but an organizing effort to try to move forward public health. So we've launched a group called Defend Public Health, which is mostly sort of academics, public health practitioners, folks in departments of public health at the federal, state, municipal level, some NGO people who feel a direct, they understand that, the federal government in kind of no uncertain terms has waged war on the field of public health. And they feel that, you know, they understand that their institutions are disintegrating, and they have a real self-interest in trying to defend the institutions and remake the institutions that they're a part of. But it's a really interesting thing. It's all the challenges that we've raised. You know, there's a lot of fear. It is scary. And people are tend to be, you know, put into their technical silos, you know, around, you know, areas of expertise or domains of work. And I think thinking about what kinds of shared interests, values, and resources can be identified within a constituency or a community of people who do share interests, values, and resources, that's a way that that they can be brought into campaign action. And so, you know, we're starting modestly, but it's an interesting example of a group of professionals, technical experts, trying to think about how to engage seriously with questions of power in ways that they had not had to under the previous sort of set of consensus positions that allowed their institutions to flourish. So, yeah, interesting stuff.
Just reflecting on what we learned during COVID, I think COVID really showed us that when things are in crisis mode, sometimes that's when we are compelled the most to change and to reflect on, you know, our individual and collective values. You know, at least I know in my institution, I think the role of ethics became even more recognized and, you know, critical since COVID, because I think we're able to put a magnifying glass to, like, what, you know, what ethics really is able to do for institutions and why it can be so crucial and critical. And so I'm hopeful for something similar to come out of this moment, because I think that there is some sense of resistance that we're all seeing in the healthcare community, because I think we do have a sort of set of shared norms and values about how we should treat patients and the communities that we serve. And you know, the current political environment is putting us at odds with that. And so I think, you know, I think that there is momentum. And so I'm hopeful that it's an opportunity just the way COVID was.
This is a great discussion. I have one thing to add, which is that I think there is a tendency, I think, within the field of public health, which is, I'm in a school of public and population health, and this is where a lot of my conversations are. I'm situated in public health ethics, about kind of wanting to go back to the way things were. And this is actually a moment to frame that as actually a problem and to point out the deficiencies in how things were in the past, and that, you know, the prior mode in which, for example, how NIH may have been organized, the way our healthcare system was financed, the way things are being reorganized are causing major problems now, and those are not to be diminished. However, I think the current moment is also an opportunity to say, well, going back to quote unquote how it was, kind of having this nostalgia, is maybe not the right move. And maybe now is a time to reimagine the future of these systems in a way that could be much more expansive, much more inclusive, much more oriented toward equity, much more oriented toward the redistribution of value in healthcare toward the people who need it the most. And that even though things might be looking a little grim, now is the time to be having those big picture thoughts rather than a kind of retrenchment into, well, let's make things go back to how they were. And I think there are a lot of resonances too between, you know, when Christian was talking about, you know, the end of the COVID pandemic, people saying, there was another group of people saying, well, now things can go back to normal. But normal before COVID, right, was not a good normal for folks who were struggling to make ends meet, for, you know, to make life in contemporary capitalism, right? And I think that now, even though things are looking like, well, it's time to, you know, protect these institutions, to protect institutions like NIH and biomedical research funding, we certainly need to do that. Now is also an opportunity to, as my colleagues have been saying in different portions of the interview today, you know, re-envision these systems to be radically more inclusive and equitable, to induce the kind of social democratic transformation that I think many people in bioethics and in academic medicine want. And I think in the case of the health sciences often want, but don't necessarily have a lot of the language to articulate because it's not really a central conversation over there, which again gets to the special place that bioethics has in these institutions to hold space for these conversations.
Oh, excellent, excellent conversation thus far. I know that we're almost out of time. So before we leave, I'm just curious, what's next, right? What's like the so what question? We had a great dialogue. We conversed about pressing topics that needed to be addressed and talked about. So I guess a 30-second spiel from each panel member. What are your recommendations on moving forward?
So we are going to have a follow-up session at American Society for Bioethics and Humanities annual meeting in Portland in 2025. It's on the Friday of the conference. I think this will have aired by the time that that happens, but there we will be talking about, we're going to have very brief opening remarks, and then we're going to go out into breakout groups. And in those sessions, they're going to be talking about, the one I'm going to lead is going to be a bit about maybe if people want to do some sort of publication around these topics, maybe something like a special issue. Also this question about, are we doing anything within ASBH? Or making some sort of formation or space to formalize some of these conversations. And the third breakout group is actually escaping me. Does anyone else remember?
I think it's about organizing, right?
Yes, that's right. And some of the work that you were just actually talking about, John.
Well, yeah, well, then maybe I can jump in and then we can keep going around the horn. I mean, I think just building off that, I think the panel at ASBH this year will be another sort of notch forward. But, you know, let me just say, I think that we need organizing. And I think even professionals who have sort of occupied institutional roles and felt secure in them, I don't know if they ought not to feel secure, but I think, you know, we do. And if that's the case, you know, thinking, you know, it'd be great to think about how to utilize ASBH as a venue to develop collectively the kinds of campaign or organizing skills that could assert a set of public ethics or public values that we aspire to in America. And, you know, obviously there will be disagreements and a heterogeneity in exactly what that looks like. But there are probably, I mean, back to what Zach had said earlier, there probably are a lot more shared sets of values and interests that we have within bioethics than we differ on. And to imagine a campaign for public ethics in America at this moment could be a powerful stance for a group of bioethicists and thinkers from around the country and around the world. So what that looks like, who knows, but it would be interesting to try.
I'm very much looking forward to this panel, and I think this is nothing that we've talked about very explicitly, and I want to say this carefully, but I think there's an opportunity for a change in how bioethics has become siloed into various niche or identitarian interests. So I'm thinking about that because two of my most vulnerable populations that I see day to day as a clinician are transgender people and immigrant folks, or especially undocumented immigrants. And the struggles of both those populations, I think, are reasonably characterized as niche interests in bioethics. They are not front and center, regularly vocalized priorities of our bioethics institutions or of ASBH. And so thinking how to break out of, again, this identitarian notion of, which I think is tied with liberalism, in useful ways when it helps reinforce autonomy, but not in useful ways when, again, these are sort of balkanized or marginalized interests, ways to bring these to the fore as part of universal or at least widely held values. And how do we do that from an organizing perspective, from a theoretician's analytical perspective, from a QI perspective? I think that's something I'm really looking forward to talking about.
I don't have much to add. I think that's exactly what we're looking forward to, is really building community and developing strategies to organize. And, you know, I think just in my own individual institutional level work, I think what I've been doing to carry this work forward has been really to sort of take a data-driven approach to demonstrate sort of what these system ethics failures look like and the impact of these. And so I used to think that the reason to do quality improvement work of our ethics consultation service was to demonstrate sort of how valuable we are to our healthcare institution. And I think that's one role of that. But now I really sort of try to collect data or think about data collection as really how can we demonstrate where these problems are, these problems that we might have been missing, and also how do we do more outreach within our institution to educate clinicians and staff about what the role of ethics can be, right? It's not just about solving these individual one-on-one dilemmas or conflicts, but really raising sort of our voices about these larger inequities that we're seeing in our healthcare system. So I think that's how I've been trying to think about this work, you know, in my own individual day-to-day as well.
It sounds like it's going to be an amazing panel. I'm really sorry I won't be at ASBH this year. And please, yes, keep us in the loop about how this progresses. Thanks so much for coming today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.